Okay. Now it's time to introduce the speaker this evening.
Woo!
So I've been running around here a lot this weekend. I really didn't catch up with him until before lunch today. And I finally got to sit down and talk with him, and we really didn't get to talking a whole lot of recovery. But I think one of the most powerful things to me was he told me how long he used in jail, and they found a message of Narcotics Anonymous inside that prison. that's what we do here. We send texts into the prison, and that's what our hope is, that we get guys like this, women like this, to find the message and come out and continue to live and spread the message. So without any further, I give you Tommy Ho, who's from upstate New York.
Speaker from last night, Lisa, did a great job. One other thing I wanted to say, a lot of us come to these conventions, we don't realize the behind-the-scenes work that goes into them, and it's a fantastic amount of work, and I want to tell you, best hospitality center I've seen anywhere, any
kind. That's right.
Very much. I understand that Danny Montino's life's on the line if I bomb. He's out. On May 24th, 1982, I was enjoying a perfectly good 5-day weekend. I was in a bar gambling over an 8-ball pool table game, and we got in a dispute. $1.50 drinks were on the line, so he was serious business. We got in a fist fight, and the two guys got thrown out. About a half hour later, when I left, one of them stabbed me in the stomach with a Heineken bottle, and I shot and killed him. His partner shot me in an innocent bystander, and I shot him, and he fell on the street, and the car ran him over. On April 23rd of 2013, I walked out of the maximum security prison at Elmira, New York. For those of you who are mathematically challenged, that was 31 straight years of incarceration. I was 21 years old when I walked out of the bar, and I was 53 years old when I left from the maximum security prison. I was raised in an Irish Catholic neighborhood, and got a lot of time, so some of these speakers come up and start, you know, when I was 6 months old, so shit, this is even more. So, I don't want to go too far back and scare anybody. I grew up on sawdust on barroom floors. My father was an alcoholic, but, you know, a benevolent one. He never hurt anybody, just a happy-go-lucky Irish drunk telling bullshit stories. And the Irish never let the truth stand in the way of a good story. So. Anyway, when I was about 8 years old, my father asked me to go to the store and get him the newspapers. On the way to the store, a man asked me to go in the basement of our apartment building to help him move a box. He was going to give me $1. So I went, and it was turned out to be a very bad individual. They found my body the next day under a pile of construction debris. He had broken both of my legs at the ankles, hung me from behind by my arms until my shoulders were ripped from the sockets, and he crushed the whole right side of my skull with rebar, and my eye was actually detached and hanging out of my face. As I got older and I realized the medical treatment I received, there was probably a sexual component to the attack, but I don't remember that. They never caught him, you know, and this was in the pre-Dr. Phil days. We didn't do, counseling. It was like, okay, forget about it, didn't happen. Just get over it, you know, forget about it. That shit's a lot easier said than done to tell somebody to get over it, you know, you're 8 years old. I look different, I have an eye patch, and kids are teasing me with pirate, I got 2 casts on my legs, you know, so I looked different, I felt different, I guess. I went from being a happy-go-lucky kid to a terrified child, you know, and I was always in a future, walk in there, and I'd be, okay, somebody comes from there, I'm gonna run here, I'll go in there, I'll down this tunnel, you know. I always had escape routes, you know, and I always thought that way, you know. And I started my first drug, and this is the only one I'm gonna mention really by name, since our literature does, was when I was like 11 years old, at Halloween 97, when I talked somebody into buying me a pint of Valley High wine. Nothing but the finest screw top money can buy, right? You gotta start off at the top. So, when I drank that, the warmth, you know, went down, and I wasn't different anymore. I didn't, you know, I wasn't apart. I was just like everybody else, having fun, laughing, wasn't scared, wasn't afraid. And I was telling the story. We lived near the Gallo Wine Factory in Queens. And they used to push three or four freight cars off on a siding the night before to unload into the factory the next day. But, you know, being civic-minded citizens, we'd help them unload a few the night before. But it was those half-gallon jugs with the finger hole. We used to drink them over our shoulder like the Beverly Hillbillies. To this day, I see one of those green bottles on my peak. You know, anything to alter who I was. Anything to be other than afraid, you know, and any of these, it didn't matter to me what. My drug of choice is, what do you got? You know, what do you got to add? And all of it, if we're not stopping until it's gone and there's no way to get any more. We all know how to do that part, you know. So, a little later on, we moved out to Queens Village in the city. Now, this is still in Queens, mind you, but there's actually trees here. I thought it went to the fucking wilderness. No bullshit. There was parks and trees. Where I lived, we had one little field on the side of the Brooklyn Queens Expressway. There was a triangle of grass, right, that was on a hill on the side of the highway. So every ball you hit when you played softball went to left field, no matter what you did. The right fielder could go take a nap. He wasn't getting no run. They were all going to wind up. My father, being the Irish jokester, he says, ah, sure. He said, that game is not run a little. So when we went out there, I thought I was in the country. And I was walking down the street on Jamaica Avenue, and I hear this pop, pop, pop. And it was an underground bowling alley that they converted into a pistol range. I said, that's the answer, guns. I will never have to be afraid again. I walked down the stairs, picked up a broom, gave myself a job, and I never left. He said, who are you? I said, I work here now. Don't worry about it. So part of my payment was I got to shoot all the rounds that I could load, you know, so 300 or 400 rounds a week. I became extremely proficient. In 1980, I was number two in the country at an international pistol shooters competition in Cheyenne, Wyoming, for my age group. It's not a very useful skill on the streets of New York, but that's what I do. You know, so it's late 70s now, early 80s. You gotta remember, kids, some people, I got arrested BC. That's before crack. So the Colombians brought us a gift up from the south there, Jackson Heights, Queens was Colombian Central. That's where it all came in, it all spread out from there. And, you know, I was doing quite a bit of it, and it's pretty expensive. So at first I would just do different jobs, taking care of weapons, things like that. Eventually my disease took me to the level where I was so, just had no care for my own life, didn't care if I lived or died, I was just ripping, running, you know, weeks on end. And if I didn't care about me, I certainly didn't care about you. And I eventually became the solution to the problems. And I was convicted of the contract murder, the DEA informant, and I was sentenced to life in prison. That's beside that other shootout. A lot of things happened. The shootout happened, I went to jail, I eventually got charged and killed 7 different people. And they told me I got life in prison. And the judge said, may the walls of the prison crumble before you ever walk the streets of the city again, you smiling, smirking henchman. Nice Irishman. Well, for those of you who don't know, prison sucks. It's no fun. So my disease is such an insidious one, right? I'm now with life in prison, and I'm sitting in a prison cell, and I'm telling myself, you know what? When you were just drinking, everything was good. It was only when you did those drugs that things got bad. You know, when you get out, just drink, and it'll be okay. My release date is a toe tag on my fucking foot, and my disease has me drinking again. What the fuck is that? Sounds like a good plan to me. So, being in prison sucks so bad, I escaped, right? In 1987, I rappelled 13 stories down the side of a building on a fire hose, right? The next day, the front page of every New York newspaper, the Daily News said, road trip. Vicious criminals loose, right? I'm watching them live on TV, tracking me with dogs alongside the Van Wyck Expressway that I never went anywhere fucking near. I walked across the street, got in a car, and drove away. They're live on my tail. And I'm watching them on TV. I don't know what those fucking dogs were firing at. It wasn't me. So I convinced myself, I said, you know, if I get out and I don't commit any more crime, I get a job, I change my name, everything will be good. They'll forget about me in a couple of years. They'll leave me alone. Come to find out, they're pretty fucking serious about these prison sentences. They actually expect you to finish them once you start them, and they frown upon early departures. So now, you know, you don't write your own plane ticket and say, I'm going on a trip. You know? No good. So, I moved to Philadelphia, changed my name.
Yeah.
Manny Young, first place. Never know what it is. So I moved to Philadelphia, changed my name, get a job, and promptly get married. Right? That's a good idea. The new wife's from Belfast, Northern Ireland. She hasn't even seen marijuana. Perfect square, she's never known nothing, right? I get a job in Norristown Wholesale Produce, loading trucks, and everything is good. And I'm continuing with the plan. Drunk as a fuck, and I go on a trip to the Philadelphia Zoo. Me and the wife and another couple. Drunk as a fuck. And I get in a staring contest with the bald eagle. I'm looking at the eagle, and this is I love birds, and I love birds in prey. This was a majestic animal. I'm looking at him. Yeah, bro, I know him. It sucks, man. What's in the cage, too? It's fucked up. That night, we decided to go back to the Philadelphia Zoo and free the eagle. So I got a pair of bolt cutters, and I'm crawling through tiger cages and shit, looking for the fucking eagle, and I'm so drunk I can't fucking find it. But I'm a dedicated addict, and I'm serious about this free the eagle plan now, right? So I said, what we need is a local guide. I need someone from Philadelphia that can take us directly to the eagle and we'll cut out the middleman, you know? So it's about 2 o'clock in the morning. We're in a bar, and I said to this guy, I said, listen, you got to come to the zoo with us. He said, fuck you told me, the zoo's closed. I said, yeah, I know the zoo's closed. We're going to go free the eagle. Now, you can be reasonably assured that if a drunk at 2 o'clock in the morning tells you, what are you fucking nuts? It's probably not a good idea. But anyway, he said, every school kid in Philadelphia knows that that eagle only has one wing. He can't fly. So, this is no drugs involved, just alcohol. I'm crawling through tiger cages trying to free an eagle that can't fucking fly. So, probably alcohol on its own is also a problem. I would have to admit that. Just another drug, you know, it's also a problem. I make piss poor decisions. So, the federal authorities have decided that I had quite enough fun. It was like 9 months later. They blew the doors off, the windows in, everything crashed once at 5 o'clock in the morning. They were like, I couldn't even roll over in bed. They were on top of me already. And they're flipping me, looking this tattoo, that tattoo. This is him, that's him, okay. The wife, sleeping long t-shirt, she gets up, what's going on? What's his bail? Where are you taking him? She says, hey, bail. He said, this guy's a convicted contract killer. He escaped from prison. He's serving a life sentence. She said, out cold, ass sticking out. I said, God. I said, come, come the poor girl, right? So, I said, can you give me a minute? Let me speak to her for a minute before we go. Oh, okay. Sure. I said, listen, honey, I haven't been in time with Trooper. She said, well, Bobby. I said, my name's Tommy. So that crazy girl stayed married to me for 19 years. So we lost the girl. But anyway, they promptly returned me to prison, and now I got like double secret, you know, I'm going to Animal House, like double secret probation. Now I'm in max. I got like, you get maximum security, and then you get put under the maximum security. You get a chain on your leg to the bed. You know, so that's one thing they never forget. So I got a few more years added on to the time, and I got some extra, you know, this and that. But prison is prison, and you know, I'm moving along. And by the way, prison changes absolutely nothing, okay? Nothing. Everything that's out on the street is available in prison. So it's a little more expensive. You got to pay import tax, right? And you know you're a fucked up addict when you're willing to swat some shit that came out of some guy's ass like 10 minutes ago. And glad to have it, right? Yo, send it down! You know, we were drinking wine. It was like 3 days in the toilet bowl. Good to go. No wine before it's time. It's still bubbling and cooking and drinking. But, you know, that was jail. After 22 years, I used in jail. I did every... Listen, I could run a course on how to get away with urine tests. If they had me ice cold, I'd have a heart attack. I'd be here, here's the cup. I'd go, oh! Elizabeth is the big one. Down I go. Boom, flopping around. I'm like, no, very pissed off. Right? And so eventually they came to my cell at like 5 o'clock in the morning and said, don't move. Don't go anywhere. Don't touch anything. Stand up. Come over here and piss in this cup. You know, so they finally got me after 22 years and I got a dirty urine. And in the interim, I'm having, in New York State, we have what we call conjugal visits, family reunion program. Every other month, I get to go spend like 3 days out in like a regular apartment with my wife, who was quite pleasurable, something I enjoyed doing, beat the hell out of prison. And they told me, you can't have any more conjugal visits until you take 6 months of an alternative program. So I said, wow, I said, what is that? They were talking about. They said AA or NA. I said, if I take them both, can I get it back in 90 days? They're always looking for the angle, right? The shortcut, give me the cliff notes. So I'll tell you why I made the decision I did in a minute. So out of the 31 years I served, almost 7 of it was in solitary confinement for different stretches, you know, different periods of time. I think the longest I was 30 months straight. But, so when you go to solitary confinement, you get absolutely nothing for like the first week till they search you properly, and then maybe they'll give you 3 paperback books after 14 days if you behave yourself. But they come down the company in front of the cells with a cart of books that's part of the special housing unit, and the books come. Now at this point, you're willing to read the toothpaste tube. So okay. So this cart comes down and it's like 4 books on it. They're all tore up. So I look at the one that's ripped up the most, right? And I said, well, that's got to be the most popular book, right? So give me that. It was a copy of One Basic Text. So major motivation for coming here was the fact that the proceeds from this go 100% to purchase a basic text of one in prison. You will never spend a better dollar. There will never be more use of your product. When you send that book to prison, they will read the covers off it, okay? And I'm living proof. I'm also gonna say that when I read it, it was the stories that got me. I'm on an island of terminal uniqueness. Nobody's like me ever, anywhere. And I read those stories, and in each one of them, I found something that was about me. It was the first time I said, wow, there's other people that think like me. There's other people that do what I do. So, and I don't want to get political or anything, but I think any book that doesn't have the stories in it is doing a disservice to the newcomer, because that's what we identify with at first. Absolutely. Just an NA purist, it's the program that saved my life, and I read all NA literature, NA approved literature. So it was very important. I went to Texas and I spoke at a book drive, because that's the most important thing. So when I read that, of course, I didn't get clean right then, But you can't unknow once you know. You know what I mean? It's in there. It's like Prego spaghetti sauce. It's in there. So when they asked me that question about 90 days of AA or NA, I remembered that book. And I said, I'll go to NA. Now, as lifers, we can have some really, really fucking weird conversations. You know, you'd be in a prison door and you say, listen, what would you be willing to do to get out of here? Would you cut off your hand? Which hand? I'm sorry, ladies. In prison, one hand's more important than the other to a man. Can't go losing your girlfriend if you have anything happen to you at the same time. Sorry, I'm not offending everybody, but it's an important distinction. You gotta keep the right hand in the right place. So, yes, I would cut off a hand. Would you cut off your leg? Is it above the knee or below the knee? I see that springy thing that guy had in the Olympics. I could fucking do work with that thing, jump. I could work with that. So before this conversation's over, I'm all stumped the fuck up and I'm getting out of prison. I'm leaving. That was the deal. Can't chase you, they can't follow your records clean, but you're all fucked. That's how bad I want to get out. So now I'm hearing about these people that voluntarily come into a place that I would cut my limbs off to get out of it. I said, I gotta go. So the first thing, I wasn't honest, I wasn't open-minded, I wasn't really, I didn't go for all of those reasons. I went to go lay low and figure out what these fucking guys were up to. Because there had to be a scam involved in this, right? There's no way, but free people, they're coming here. First thing I came up with, I said, they're gay. See, my ego, I'm so fucking good looking, some three gay guys breaking into a maximum security prison to come find me, right? No, they weren't gay, right? But, and I said, I'm going to be respectful, but I'm going to figure out what they're up to. And I sat there, and one by one, as these guys shared openly and honestly their experience, strength, and hope, the bricks in my wall of tumbling and neediness got kicked the fuck away, you know? And I really began to identify the same way I had done when I read those stories in the basic text years before. So I listened, and I stayed. And we used that basic text, and we spread meetings, you know, and I got clean, and I started to think clean. So now I'm 22 years into a prison bed, and I live my prison life like I want to die. I take drugs from people, and I don't pay for it. I don't give a fuck. Get a knife. You know, now I decided I want to live, but I still got a lot of those people that remember what I owe them and all this other shit. So it's a difficult balance once you decide I want to live, I don't want to live a criminal lifestyle anymore, I want to live clean in the bigger sense of the word, a clean life. You know, today I try to live my life as if the newcomer is always watching me. You know, you don't go into a meeting, talk all that NA great shit, and then go outside and live foul. And the newcomer sees you and they say, this must be bullshit. He says that and he does this. You know, so I try. You know, we're not perfect. You know, I certainly try. I don't do it all the time, but I like to conduct myself as if the newcomer is always watching me. So, let me get out of prison. I like this. You know, when you speak, I look at that and I say, okay, I've been in prison too long. So, I eventually started going to the parole board at, I forget what I had, 8 months, some crazy number. And they said, no, don't be ridiculous, 2 years. And then they gave me 1 year. And then finally, on the third try at the parole board, I was given a release date, which was shocking. I couldn't believe it. Nobody else could either. So I get a release date, and now it's become very difficult. I got a sponsor on the street that I've been doing steps with in the mail. He wants me to get into all this detail and all this other thing in the mail. And I said, listen, I'm not writing that shit down. The statute of limitations ain't up. That's a fucking walking indictment. I'm not writing none of that shit down. You want to hear that, you come here, and I'll tell it to you in the ear. You know, but I didn't want to write stuff down. But, you know, so he tells me, listen, you got to go make 90 meetings in 90. I'm a hard-headed motherfucker. I got 9 fucking years. That's when new comes. What the fuck you tell me to take 90 meetings? I said, okay. You know, right away, I was looking to take my will back. You know? But I said, okay, time out. So I moved to a place. I'm luckier than a lot of newcomers. I came to a place that I had never been before. I didn't pass places that were triggering things. I wasn't around people that I used to use with. We ended all dead. You know, it's like 30-something years ago. Nothing's there. They gave me keys to my apartment building and my 1979 Grand Torino. The apartment building's in a landfill somewhere, and the car owner knows, but this is the property they gave me back, you know? And so I get there, I go, okay? 90 meetings. I made 120 meetings in my first 90 days on a bicycle in the Catskill Mountains, okay? The two things, number one, I lost 20 pounds. Second, and more importantly, and this is the message to all of us in the new coming, it created a foundation of the fellowship upon which I stand today. I can go anywhere. We know the routine. You could put me in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and I'm going to find the Eskimo that got the ship. There's a pattern. You know, you meet a girl, you go, where's the ship? And before you know it, you cop. So I went to a place and met only people that were interested in recovery. They weren't interested in that. I don't know where it is. You know, I can't say, hey, fuck it, let me go get high. I don't even know where to go. I don't know who to call, don't care. You know, it's not part of my makeup. But I got all of those people who care about me, you know, and my development. Okay, so when I got arrested, cell phones were as big as a brick. We were joking about Danny having a beauty play. He had a big cell phone as big as a brick, and it came in a backpack. Nobody had it, right? So I get out of prison, and I got fucking cars talking to me. This is some Star Wars shit. We're leaving the prison, and the car says, you're now passing historic Catskill. I said, who the fuck is that? She knows the car. It tells you where you are, and it gives you a little sign. I said, what the fuck? I went into Sam's Club and almost had an epileptic seizure. Fucking TV's the biggest size of a van. I've been looking at it 12 inches black and white. And they're all colors and flashing. I'm getting sensory overload, you know? And people in the fellowship made all of that stuff funny. They weren't making fun of me. I didn't even have to fill up gas. I walked up there and I'm like looking. I got to put a card there. I have to push buttons. It's very complicated, man. You just pump gas and pay for the money. Now I got to learn how to pump gas. I have to learn about credit cards. I have to learn all kinds of things. But it became funny. It became humorous because I was around people that really had an interest in me doing well. You know? One of the things, one of the first nights when I was out, my wife and I live in Woodstock, New York. I'm a city that's stuck in the country. So I went from New York City to, I lived in upstate New York for 31 years. They moved it all around. I was telling you, it's a funny story. The guy says, so I live in Auburn. I said, yeah, I lived in Auburn for 3 years too. He said, where'd you live? I said, the big building up on the hill there. He knows, he goes, it's a lot of security, you know. But he says, oh, okay. I lived in Auburn. But I went to all these places around New York. He said, where are you from? I said, I guess I'm from upstate New York. I've been up there a lot longer than I've been in the city. But now I live in Woodstock, and I really enjoy it. I have great meetings, you know. When they have them. COVID did a lot of damage. A lot of meetings never started back up. But so I was out in, again, we're in a prison yard in this maximum security prison called Shawshank, like the movie Shawshank, but Shawshank, it's an Indian name. And you used to be able to look, it's by New Paltz, New York, and you can see these cliffs, big rock cliffs, and they're famous for rock climbing all over the Northeast. People come from all over the place to go rock climbing there. But I used to hang around there in the 1970s when we were teenagers. We'd steal a U-Haul van and keg of beer and drive up to New Paltz and, you know, do us. We were expanding our minds in the woods. Something about the 70s, it was all letters. It's LSD, DMT, THC, SMP. It was all letters in the 70s, but, you know, we tried them. And so I used to tell the fellas, hey, listen, I used to hang around over there. Yeah, shut the fuck up. All right. So I get out, and my wife and I go for a walk in the country. We're walking down the country road. I love when the trees come together and form like a tunnel through the road. And I remember getting to about 300 feet, 200 feet, and I like, it was like instinct was telling me to stop and make a left. I was like, and I realized I hadn't walked in a straight line more than like 300 feet in over 30 years. because that's about the biggest prison yard I was ever in. You have to make a turn, you gotta turn. And it was like a real spiritual experience for me to walk through that invisible barrier, and I passed that turn left point, straight ahead into a life of beyond my wildest dreams. So, amazing things. We're gonna do some couple of higher power moments, right? One of them was very interesting. I had one of the stories particularly pertained. I caught it. I'm not going to in any way give it away because the guy was, he respects his privacy. He doesn't want me to like divulge who it is exactly. So I read one of the stories. I really, really dug it. So I get out of prison, and my wife, who's 39 years clean, and she's on the world board. Right? So I have very good recovery at home. She's recommending all these sponsors to me, you know? She says, how about that guy over there? He's got 38 years. He was there when Moses wrote the tablets down. He actually changed the toilet paper in Jimmy Cain's bathroom. Right? So he's coming up with all this shit, and I'm looking at the guy and I said, motherfucker wears brown socks with blue pants. Ain't no fucking way in the world. So this guy might have been the greatest recovery guy in the world, but it just wasn't for me. She's offering all these guys. And I'm at this meeting on some way out in Phoenicia, New York, in the backwoods, and there's a speaker. And he's speaking, and he's on and on, and, you know, just something he said caught me. And he had over 25 years, and I went up and asked him to be my sponsor. So, you know, time's going on, and I'm talking, it's like 6 months later, and I'm telling him about, you know, how I found the basic text. And he goes, you really don't know, do you? I said, no, what? He said, that's my story. That's his story of basic tech. I'm getting goosebumps right here. The one that attracted me, out of all the people all over the world write these stories, I find him in a backwoods meeting in Phoenicia, New York, the sponsor from the story that got my eye. So I'm like, okay. I look up sometimes and go, okay, I got you. Follow instructions, boss. So, you know, we went our different ways that, you know, and that's part of the NA story. Sometimes, you know, we sponsor people or we get sponsored by people and we come to a crossroads or we come to a growing point or, you know, and we respectfully, cordially move on. Thank you for what you know, I got. And so it's not my sponsor anymore, still good friends. But, you know, so I wind up getting a job working for the state that incarcerated me for 31 years, right? I have an office on the fifth floor of the New York State Capitol. I have the keys to the fucking Capitol. So it's just beyond your wildest dreams. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, I haven't been to work in a while. I had a very bad motorcycle accident. Maybe I'll touch on that sometime later. But it's just amazing. I'm on the floor of the New York State Assembly. They're debating bills, and I got my office is up on the fifth floor on the back. You can go outside my office, these big windows, and that's the assembly cigar lounge. So all the assembly members that smoke cigars, they're friends of mine, they can all come to my office and we all smoke cigars and discuss the business of the day, you know. So people say, why do you work for the assembly? I said, I don't know about politics here, but it's probably the only job I could get where I wasn't the biggest crook in the room. The FBI came in one day, right past me. I said, "Whoops, so he's right there." You know, we got it. And they were making pinches left and right. But, they're good people. I make a joke at their expense. But. So I originally started working in the maintenance department. I later went back to college, and I got another. I have a couple of college degrees. I got another degree in public policy. So I got a promotion as soon as I graduated to, I'm the project manager for all assembly buildings in the state, from Buffalo to New York City, all over the state. Every building in the state, anything that needs to be done has to go through me. It did, but anyway. So I'm working in the maintenance department when I started. And we're doing the annual changing of the light bulbs. Taxpayers love these stories. So we change every fucking light bulb the assembly chamber, whether it needs it or not. If it's out, if it ain't out, doesn't matter. These chandeliers are like, they have to be lowered by these big cranks, and that are humongous, that are 9,000 pounds. So they bring them down, they have to move all the desks off the floor. So you change them when you get the chance, right? So I'm about 200 molds into this process. I'm getting like, with a carpal tunnel at the wrist, and I'm getting an attitude. Here I am, fresh out of prison. I got a job working for the fucking state, and I'm getting an attitude because why? I'm better than this. You can get a monkey to change light bulbs. I'm a carpenter. I do big stuff, you know? So the supervisor says, Tommy says, go in the speaker's office and change the batteries in these clocks. So I get out of here. I go in this guy's office. He's got about 50 fucking clocks. Everybody, you ever see those plaques? You get plaques from people and it's got the little clock in it. It's got about 50 of them. The batteries are about this fucking big, and I'm blind from reading 30 years in a prison cell. I can't see shit. So now I'm changing little baby tiny batteries that are dropping, can't see. So there's a marble like plinth on his desk, and it's got a clock in it. And I pick it up from the desk, and I look down at the desk, and I said, the guy, I want this. I need this fucking desk. And the guy says, yeah, I'm Thomas Edison. I made the light bulb. I said, this is a 72-inch double-pad Tremont desk that were made in a specialty shop in the Auburn Correctional Facility in the summer of 1998, and I made every fucking one of them. So now, sometimes my higher power gives me a nudge, and sometimes I get a swift kick in the ass. You ain't happy changing light bulbs. You can go back to making these fucking desks real fucking quick. Say again. Okay, big guy. You know, sometimes when we're new, we need a little more encouragement from the big guy. You know, and as you get cleaner, at least as I did, and you know, got some clarity, I realized that these things had been going on in my life for years. I just didn't see them. I didn't recognize them. Anything that was good is because I'm so great. If it went bad, it's because you're a fucking idiot and you fucked it up. Nothing was my fault. You know what I mean? Did that. I had to be, without question, the smartest person in the room, no question. And I was very successful. For 31 years, I was the smartest person in the room. I was the only fucking person in the room. I was the smartest person in the room. And I could win arguments for myself and all of that. So, you know, so these things happen. You know, my brother comes to see me. It's like 2 weeks after I get out. It's Mother's Day. And he says, calls me, he says, you want to go rock climbing? I'm like, well, let me see. I've been stabbed 9 times. I've been shot 3 times. Had my throat cut with a straight razor. Just got out of prison. Do I want to go die on a rock? Probably not. In case you ladies or men don't know, men are fucking stupid. I can't say no. It's macho again. You're gonna climb the rock? I'll climb the rock. So he comes and gets me, put the backpacks on, and we're trekking up this thing and sweating, going, and finally he puts the pack down. I said, wow, yeah, that was good. Fucking rock climbing, man, that's tough. He goes, we're just getting started. And I'm looking, no bullshit, I got pictures. Straight fucking up, flat wall like this. I said, you gotta be fucking kidding. He said, now he's gonna give me instructions on rock climbing etiquette. First of all, he puts his ballerina slippers on me. I get a fucking a harness that squeezes shit that ain't supposed to squeeze. I'm speaking with a high C. And he says, get in one with the rock. Work it out for yourself. Don't ask for help. I get about 150 feet up this rock and I'm clinging there like a spider monkey getting ready to die. I can't go back, I go forward. I just call back. I said, Rob, which way do I go? And he said, sometimes you need to go back to go forward. I said, I don't need any philosophical bullshit. But I did what he said. I took a step back to the place I had 2 really good footholds. And I was able to shake my arms out and get the cramps out. And when I looked up, there were chalk marks. That's how you follow the route. There were 3 different chalk marks, 3 different ways to go. You know, I remained teachable in all aspects of my life. This addict, when confronted with choices, 3 choices, they all suck. Which one sucks the least? Because I have to choose, right? I can choose not to choose. I can decide not to make a choice right now. I can take that step back. Look for a clearer way to get something done. Call somebody on the phone. Call somebody who has more information in this area than I do. And that's what I learned, is to back up, slow down, ask for help. Doesn't make you lesser of a man, makes you smarter. You know, men were hard-headed. So anyway, I continued this climb. And I get up to the top. It was an overcast day. Some biblical shit. I flop over on the top of the rock, exhausted, and the sun comes through the cloud. The cloud opens up, and the beam of light like hits me up on top of this rock. And I looked off to the south, and I saw the gun tower over the prison yard where I used to sit. And I looked down at my brother, and I said, I'm going to need a minute of you. And I cried for about a half an hour, for all the men I left behind, for all the years I lost, but mainly out of sheer gratitude that some addicts got together, sent basic texts into a prison, and then followed it up with H&I meetings to save this addict's life, because I would not be here tonight had they not brought that message to me. I wasn't able to get out, and it really rang a tone. And we've seen it in prison many times. We have all kinds of divisions. It's like out here, we put them aside for our commonality, the we that she was speaking about. The we is more important in Narcotics Anonymous than our petty differences. In prison, you got the black, the white, the Spanish, then you got upstate, downstate. You know, who talks to who, doesn't talk to who. When we came into those meetings and we built a commonality of trust, all of that stuff went out the window. We didn't bother with any of that racial stuff. Who this? Are you an addict yet? You earned your seat, sit down. That was all that was required. Okay, and we had some magic. When that trust was built, when we achieved it, and we trusted each other enough to open up, because look, information is power. You don't want to get it thrown back in your face in the prison yard 2 weeks from now. But if you really trust and share openly and honestly in that environment, it's literally pure magic. One of the last things that sold me on Narcotics Anonymous, it was a blizzard. It was really, really snowing, and so it's Tuesday night, time for the meeting. Of course we're going. Fuck else are we gonna go? It's coffee and donuts over there. I'm not, you know, my dad's car's wide open, right? So we show up at the meeting, and the two civilians bringing the meeting information out are there. I said, bro, what the fuck are you doing here? It's a blizzard. He said, never stop me from getting high. I said, holy shit. I mean, I just locked into that and identified so much, because there was, look, if I had money in my pocket, it was night, if the sun was going down, I was going out. It ain't, no doubt about it. Blizzard, smizzard, hurricane, we'll have a party, we'll drink hurricane. It didn't matter, we were going out. So a lot of that stuff that they brought into us really carried it. When I got out, the first place they allowed me to go, really, to leave the state, was the Philadelphia Convention. Here in 2013, right? Now remember, the last free breath I took was in Philadelphia. The last time I walked on the street was walking into that federal building on 5th and Market, right? So I get out of prison, and the first place I go is to Philadelphia. And I walk down to that courthouse, and I took a selfie outside the courthouse. I know how selfies, I'm taking selfies. But as I'm walking around the convention, I'm just listening. I'm like soaking everything up like a sponge. I'm like a happy idiot, you know? And anytime I heard someone in the crowd, like mentioning in conversation, H&I, I don't care if I knew them, whatever, I said, H&I, let me tell you about H&I. And I jumped in. I was just so thankful, so grateful, just wanted them to hear. And it's been amazing, because I've been places and I've shared, and I've had people come up to me and say, you know, I've been carrying a meeting into this place for like 3 years, and I'm not sure I'm getting to them. I'm not sure it's doing any good. I think I'm going to give up the commitment. And then I heard you speak, you know. And I said, and it goes back to what I said. And I think Lisa mentioned something about that. You can't unknow it once you know it. I know it. I know there's an answer. I know there's a solution. I know it. That's all you can do. You got to turn the rest over to the big guy. You know what I mean? The higher power. The rest, I carried the message. They carried the message. I knew it was there. And I availed myself of it. So many people who did, and many people who didn't, and most of them are dead. You know, know, now I'm starting to ramble a little bit. I know she said last night she was going, but I hope that isn't too short. Good? I got another half. Okay, so wait a minute. I'm 5 years old. I'm going to reboot. Okay, let me gather my thoughts. I'll go somewhere else. So after Philadelphia, just another aside of great thinking while drinking, right? So I moved to Florida. I'm living like Safety Harbor, Dunedin area there in a trailer. And I get word from New York that they're searching people that I knew that now live out of state. And that's who I was staying with, some girl I used to know. So I'm like, wow, they're getting close. So she worked at a truck stop. She's a manager. I said, can you give this card to one of the truckers and tell them to mail it from like Montana or Nebraska? That's my great plan, right? They're going to see the postmarks in Nebraska. They're going to go look in Nebraska while I'm in Florida. I send the judge a postcard. I said, the walls didn't crumble. I knocked them down. Enjoy yourself until I see you soon, right? So I was just being a smart ass. The next day, the New York Post writes, fugitive killer, vows revenge. So I went from having like 10 FBI agents on my case to like 50 FBI agents on my case every day because they think I'm trying to hunt down the judge. So that was another great example of good thinking, you know? You were talking, as an addict, always, your first thought, your initial thought in a moment of crisis is wrong. It's wrong. You're back in someone's car in the parking lot, don't think about fleeing. You have to stop. You have to be responsible citizens. Don't floor it. You know, but your first instinct is always wrong. You know, and I only learned that, you know, one of the most important programs also, there was a program where they would take in people and they would call where you were going and they would call people where you were being released to and they would automatically start picking you up and carry you to a meeting. I have found that it's of vital importance that the addict get to a meeting early when they get out of prison. You know, if they don't go to a meeting right off the bat, oh, I'll do that next week, I'll do that later, it's probably not going to happen. And I'm sweating my ass off. It's going. I'm sorry, that's about all I got, folks. Thanks. Yeah.